Texas Academy course in July 2013 titled Adventures in Energy Economics. So this second lecture I titled Dealing with Externalities, because that's a huge issue in the modern economics of climate change, and it underlies just about every recommendation for why the government ought to interfere with the market economy when it comes to the context of anything having to do with the energy sector. And of course, a lot of what we cover today will be applicable not just to the narrow issue of energy economics, but also the environment in general and even beyond that. There's plenty of reasons or applications of so-called market failure relying on what are called externalities. So the framework that you get from the readings from this week's court lecture will be applicable beyond just the narrow topics we're talking about in this lecture. Okay, so as you can see from this outline here, we've got to cover the Pigouvian framework after Arthur Pigou. Then we're going to go into what's called the post theorem. So these are obviously not Austrian. And I see that for some reason the Roman numeral got screwed up. This should be a 2 and that should be a 3. So, but you need to kind of understand this general background so that you can then understand the Austrian view in contrast. All right, and then we'll talk about Rothbard in particular, and other than give you some examples of what free market environmentalism is like and how that's not a contradiction in terms. Before I jump into this, let me just give a general announcement. For anybody who's in the D.C. area, next week on July 17th, the Institute for Energy Research, we're having a panel on carbon taxes. I guess I'll remind you again next week. I'll be in D.C. actually for the lecture next week. I'll be at a hotel room broadcasting you guys. But anyway, if you're interested in this stuff, you can follow the event, or if you're local, you can try to go to it. And that's the information there. I just put it in the chat box if you're interested. So that's next week, where we'll in this course, in the upcoming lectures, we'll cover some of the stuff that I'm going to be presenting at that conference. Okay, let's first, before we get into tonight's main topic, I just wanted to follow up with something from last week, from week one, where I was talking about the total, I'm tempted to say supply, but the word supply has a very specific meaning in economics, so just say reserves of crude oil and natural gas. And I told you guys that you could plot how many years left of oil and gas there were according to the official estimates and the kind of things that the media would typically use when giving a report on that kind of statistic. And it actually goes up over time. All right. So for another project, I actually had to go look that stuff up anyway last week. And then I realized, oh, wait a minute, I might as well just capture the image and show you guys. So what this chart is showing here is this is relying on the data supplied by the Energy Information Administration, the EIA. That's the U.S. government's main energy clearinghouse at this point. And so what it is, it's from 1980 to 2011. That was the latest year that they had the figures for. And you're asking the question, what are the total proved reserves of crude oil and also of natural gas? So remember, proved reserves is a very technical term in this area, and it means that it's reserves that we're reasonably certain are there and can be recovered with existing technologies and market conditions. All right, so so that term proved means that it's not just speculation. Like they're pretty sure that the stuff is there and that they know how to get it. Because there's other reserves that it's the kind of thing where, well, yeah, we know that, in those rock formations, there's a bunch of natural gas, but we don't have the technology, or rather we do have the technology, but it would cost us so much money to get it out that it wouldn't be worthwhile. Okay. So even there, notice, the idea of having oil reserves or natural gas reserves is inherently an economic concept, that it's not merely an issue. I mean, just give you another example. Suppose scientists were absolutely certain that there were a trillion barrels of crude oil on an asteroid that was beyond Mars, orbiting the sun, and they say, "Oh, we're sure it's there." And then, you know, the president said, "Well, can we get it?" And you know, all the physicists and chemists and so on, and literal rocket scientists said, "Well, yeah, we have the technology to get it." And he said, "Okay, great. Well, let's go get it then." And they said, "Well, but you know, it would cost us $10 trillion to go get all that stuff." You see what I'm saying? So it's not that it wouldn't be as obvious that you'd want to do it. So that's what I'm saying. Or if it costs $10 trillion, whatever the number would have to be, but you can see how to be relevant economically, it's not enough just that humans know somewhere on Earth there's reserves of oil and gas, but also can we get them with existing technologies and in a cost-effective manner. Okay, so anyway, that's what these numbers mean, but I've divided it. So this axis here, well, the y-axis is years. That's what that is. All right, so for each of these years, it would be that figure for that year of what was the estimate in that particular year of the global crude reserves of either crude oil or natural gas. And then I divided it by that year's production level. And so that's what gives you the figure. So the idea is at any given time, you could say, given current rates of consumption and given our current knowledge about how much, what the level of crude reserves are, how many years left do we have? Okay, so in a crude, sort of naive environmentalist Malthusian perspective, or people who would say, and this isn't a straw man. I have seen people saying things like, you know, writing letters to the editor, saying stuff like, according to scientists, we only have 27 years left of oil. And so that's why it's imperative for our government to begin funding alternative energy sources like solar and wind power. Because the idea is we're going to run out in 27 years. So we better get off our butt and start developing other energy sources before the end is too late. And so I'm saying that is crazy. That just shows a fundamental misunderstanding of what those numbers mean and how a market economy works and deals with so-called exhaustible or finite resources. Because if that were the case, then you would expect at best you'd start out with like 27 years left, then the next year you have 26 years, then 25, then 24. And in fact, it would even fall more quickly because consumption rates tend to go up over time as economies develop and as there's more population. So for a dwindling physical stockpile of the resource, if you're using more and more every year, generally speaking, then the number of years left should actually be falling faster than 1 year left per year. Anyway, you can see how it is empirically that typically it would go up over time and then it leveled off a bit, but clearly it's not falling over time. And in particular, like in 1980, crude oil, the actual number was like 27.5. So the idea would be, okay, in 1980, they had 27 and a half years left. So then you go forward to 2007 and a half, or the year 2008, which is 28 years later, and was the world on the brink of running out of crude oil? No. Not only did they have more in terms of absolute number of barrels than crude reserve that had been discovered, but that number divided by the rising consumption rate was even higher, right? So you had a much bigger margin for error or margin of safety by that. And again, just to make sure you guys get the important point here, the reason for this, this is not surprising. You would expect other things equal that as capitalism matures, as economies grow richer, among the other things we would do is go find ourselves a bigger cushion of oil and gas reserves. In addition to giving more air conditioning to people, developing better diets and so forth, right? So that's just another example of how it is that things tend to get better over time. Okay, so let's now talk about the main topic for tonight, which is the Pigouvian, the first part of this. We're talking about externalities, and this is the Pigouvian framework, and that's the adjective derived from this guy's, this economist, Arthur Cecil Pigou, which he developed in this book, Economics of Welfare. So here, the term welfare, don't be confused. We're talking about welfare economics. We don't mean welfare like money that the government gives to poor people. That's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about welfare economics. So the first thing is, make sure you guys know, is that in standard mainstream economics, there's what's called welfare theorems, and a standard result is that markets satisfy welfare conditions under certain conditions. All right. So for you don't need to, I'm not going to quiz you on this, but I just want to give you guys the basic framework here. So if people are price takers, if everybody's informed about what the various prices are, and a few other conditions, and most importantly, most relevant for our discussion tonight, if all of the costs and benefits of market transactions are internalized to the parties who are conducting them, then you get this nice result that a decentralized competitive equilibrium outcome satisfies all of these normative conditions that you would want as a central planner, if you will. Okay, so the idea is, what they did is they started formally modeling Adam Smith's invisible hand metaphor and showing that, wow, you know, actually, if a market worked in a certain way, then there'd be no role for the government to improve upon anything. That the market would, as if by an invisible hand, people just acting in their own narrow interest, maximizing their own utility functions, or whatever you want to say, maximizing profit if you're a business person or a firm, actually, there's an efficient allocation of resources, the way that a mainstream economist would define efficient. Okay, so what's the problem? The problem possibly comes in, let me clean this up a bit. All right, well, not doing too well cleaning that up. Let me just go ahead and keep writing. The problem comes in when there are positive or negative externalities. So an externality means that two people are engaged in a market transaction and they are conferring either benefits or harms on some third party who has no say in the original transaction. So the idea is what ends up happening, and again, it can be positive or negative. So a positive externality is something like, if you choose to go to school and become educated, in a standard Pigouvian framework, an economist might say, you becoming educated, that benefits you, it's true, but you know what, then you're a better informed citizen and you make better decisions at the ballot box, and so we want to go ahead and, you know, you're not getting as much education as you ought to. Or maybe even a better example, since many of you hearing this lecture are going to disagree with so much in that last scenario, maybe a better example would be to get vaccinated against tuberculosis or something like that, back when tuberculosis was a real big problem. And so a mainstream economist relying on a Pigouvian framework might say, yes, you would think, you know, left to their own devices, many parents would choose to have their child vaccinated just because comparing the costs and benefits of getting it, but you know, makes the benefits outweigh the cost, so they would do it. But you know what? Some of them might not. And if they, and part of what's leading them to that decision is they don't really take into account, they're just worried about whether their own kid gets tuberculosis or not. And so if they start thinking that, well, come on, what are the chances he's going to get it? And they might not opt for the vaccination because they're worried about side effects or just the actual cost of the procedure, whatever, the monetary expense. But they're not taking into account the fact that, well, gee, if you don't do that, then you could be, your kid could be giving tuberculosis to others. So there the idea is getting vaccinated would confer positive externalities, again, in the standard mainstream framework. And so that's what would lead to the role for the government to come in and subsidize those activities. On the other hand, and what we'll focus on more tonight, and what usually is the argument in environmental contexts, is that certain market activities can have a negative externality. And so there the idea is you are imposing harms on third parties. So a classic example is if you're a factory that dumps pollution into the air or into the river, they're not adequately taking that into account. So let me just make sure you guys understand here. In the standard mainstream framework, it's the answer is not to completely stop the activity in question. So this is really important. Make sure you get this. The issue is not, oh my gosh, there's some activity that's causing a negative externality, so the government has to come in and stamp it out of existence. That we need to figure out how to eradicate all activities that confer negative externalities from the face of the earth. That's not the answer, even in the mainstream framework. The alleged problem is that there's, let me just make sure I'm not, okay. I was just looking ahead to make sure I wasn't anticipating slides. The problem is that if there's an externality, either positive or negative, the individuals engaging in that particular activity, their marginal incentives are not right. And so they either produce too much of it or too little. So again, let's just focus on negative externalities because that's kind of the default when it comes to environmental stuff. So let's say it's a factory that's making television sets, and part of what it's doing is dumping a certain waste product from the manufacturing process into the river, and then that's killing the fish. And so then the people who normally fish in that river, you know, their catch is lower than it otherwise would be. So what's happening is the people making television sets are hurting the people who fish in that river downstream. So the answer is not that, oh, so we better have the government come in and outlaw the production of television sets, or even to tell that firm you have to stop dumping stuff in the river. Because who's to say that the efficient outcome is to have zero television sets and more fish? You see what I'm saying? So the problem is, again, in the mainstream Pigouvian framework, when you're making television sets, if there were no externalities, the optimal number of television sets would be made. So they would, the in equilibrium, they would keep making television sets so long as the market price was higher than the marginal cost of production. And they would expand it until the point where it was basically just about even, right? So if the market price were higher than the marginal cost of production, so let's say the market price of the television set is $100, and the marginal cost of making another TV set is only $90, well, then the profit and loss mechanism would lead the firm to make one more unit, right? Because they could sell it for $100 and the marginal cost is only $90, so they make that extra profit of $10. So they're going to keep expanding their output of television sets until the point at which adding one more to an output, the marginal cost is higher than the price. They're not going to produce that particular unit. So long as that figure of marginal cost captures all of the relevant costs, that's good. But the idea is, no, it's since they're hurting the fish, the more they produce, the more fish they're killing, they're not taking that cost into account, and so they're producing too many TVs. So the answer is not stop making TVs, because then, that doesn't mean that the optimal number of TVs is zero. It's just saying the market outcome is inefficiently high because there's an important cost that the owners of the plant have not taken into account. So a standard response is to come in with a Pigouvian tax. So if it turned out that for every TV set they made, they killed, they had to dump so much stuff in the river that about $2 worth of fish got killed, then they would come in and impose a Pigouvian tax of $2 per television set on the people running the factory. And so then now they would re-optimize. In the presence of that tax, they would cut back their output of television sets to the socially correct level. So the issue is they want the social marginal benefits to equal the social marginal cost. Whereas in a private setting, it's the private marginal benefits to equal the private marginal cost. So it's this issue of positive or negative externalities that cause the social to not be equal to the private. I'll just say that summary one more time to make sure you got it. So again, what always happens in a private competitive outcome is that the firm will produce at the level at which the private marginal benefits equal the private marginal cost. But what the economists want to have happen is that the firm produces to the level at which the social marginal benefits equal the social marginal costs. And so that's the issue. So if there's a positive or negative externality, it can make the private and social values diverge. And that's then the door through which the economist can recommend either a subsidy in case of the social benefits are higher than the private benefits, like it would be in the vaccine example, if you thought vaccines were good, or cases where the social costs are higher than the private costs, as it is in the example where the people making the television sets are dumping stuff in the river. So they know the costs of the materials to make the televisions. They know the wages they have to pay the workers to work in the factory to make the televisions, right? So that's the issue. Okay, now Ronald Coase's so-called theorem, what people refer to as the Coase theorem. There's literally a law and economics courses that spend several weeks just on this topic, right? So that's, we're going to just talk about it for a little bit tonight. I want to make sure you understand the framework. The other, the problem with this is a lot of people misunderstand what the Coase theorem is. And it's actually, he doesn't, I tried rereading his original article today just to see, you know, should I try to work through the specific examples? And it wasn't great. Meaning it's hard to step back and understand the big picture world. Okay, so we're just backing up. We had a sound issue, so some of this might be redundant. Let me just give the big picture as to what the Pigouvian framework is, in case you got lost with some of the details. So the idea is that individuals in the private market will come together and they will bargain with each other, and in equilibrium, the outcome is going to be that the level of production, so let's say if it's television sets, the number of television sets produced is going to be such that the private marginal benefit equals the private marginal cost. Because if somebody in the private, if the private marginal benefits of one more television set are $100, that means somebody, a consumer, is willing to pay $100 for another television set, or up to $100 for another television set, because he's getting marginal benefits of obtaining it of $100. And so somebody, a firm, is going to be willing to give that to him so long as the marginal costs of producing it are less than that. And so, and again, this is all assuming firms are price takers and there's perfect information and all that kind of stuff. So if you think about it, the only way for equilibrium to occur in that kind of setting is where output expands until the point at which producing one more television set, the marginal cost of that last set would be higher than the marginal benefit to the consumer who would be getting it. Okay, so that's fine. And that's actually what you would want to have happen. If everybody's doing that in every industry, resources are correctly allocated according to the, you know, mainstream models and their definitions of efficiency. Except the problem is, in cases where the private and the social diverge. And so if there's a positive externality, what that means is the activity under consideration is giving benefits to other people who aren't paying for it. It's just showering these free benefits on other people. And so when you take that full social benefit of doing more of this activity into account, you'd actually want to do more of it. But yet, since those other parties aren't actually paying, the people who are producing the thing aren't seeing that, and they're only taking into account the private benefit because that's what they're getting paid for. So again, so when it comes to a positive externality, the problem is the level of output is inefficiently low because output expands up until the point at which the private marginal benefit equals the private marginal cost, but actually the social marginal benefit is higher than the private marginal benefit, and so it doesn't go far enough. You actually ought to be producing more of that thing. So popular examples in a textbook would be things like education, that if you send somebody to school, that's not only benefiting them, but it's benefiting everybody else, and so more people ought to be going to school longer. Again, I know talking to this crowd, a lot of you would say, well, no, that doesn't make any sense. I think going to school is a waste of time. But again, I'm talking about the standard textbook treatment of this. Or getting vaccinated. Again, a hot button issue in today's climate, but that would be a textbook thing where they would have thought clearly it benefits people, the more people who get vaccinated, because now there's less ability for these problems to manifest or to propagate throughout the community. And so if you vaccinate your kid, you're not just helping your own family, you're helping all your neighbors too. And so, but because you're not thinking like that, there's an inefficiently low number of vaccinations. And so that is the economistic way that you could try to justify having the government subsidize vaccination. That is, let's have the government just pick up the bill, because left to their own private devices, people would get an inefficiently low number. On the other hand, when there's negative externalities, the other way around, that the people in question are expanding output beyond the point at which it's optimal. So if it's a if it's a factory making television sets and they're dumping stuff in the river, the owner of the factory, he's taking costs into consideration, because the more televisions he makes, he's got to have the workers work longer shifts, so he's got to pay more in wages. He's got to use more raw materials. He's got to use more electricity to run the machines in the factory, and so on. So his costs of production get higher the bigger his output. And the more televisions he makes, presumably that pushes down the market price. And so at some point, you know, he's not going to produce an infinite number of television sets, even if he's dumping stuff in the river. At some point, even just considering the private costs and benefits and neglecting the fact that he's dumping stuff in the river, he will stop. He will only produce a finite number of television sets, because at some point, the marginal cost to the owner of making one more set is lower than the current market price, which is a gauge or a proxy for the marginal benefits that another consumer would get from obtaining one more television set. Because that's why it's the market price. Someone's willing to pay it. Okay, so in this case, the private marginal cost is lower than the private social cost, that the owner of the factory is not fully taking into account all of the costs of producing more television sets, and so he's making an inefficiently high number of them. And so if the government came in and levied a Pavlovian tax, that would help the factory owner internalize the externality. So that's let me just type that in. That's a popular phrase in this literature. So a Pavlovian tax leads someone to internalize the externality. Externality. So again, let me just emphasize, the point is not to make television set production disappear. It's not that the government or the economists relying on this framework is trying to get all television producers to stop producing television sets. So they're still dumping stuff in the river. Make sure you guys get that. The issue is not, oh my gosh, they're dumping stuff in the river, so we need to do something so nobody drops anything else in rivers anymore, or there's zero air pollution. That's not what they're saying. What they're saying is, because these production processes unavoidably confer negative externalities on others, you're not correctly calibrating marginal costs and marginal benefits, and so you're producing too much, so we're going to give you a tax that in theory is calibrated to the marginal levels of those negative externalities, and then we let you reoptimize. So you're still producing television sets and you're still dumping stuff in the river. But the point is, you've reduced how many television sets you're making such that, again, in theory, assuming all this framework made sense and the tax is the right level, that now the private producer of television sets, when he's considering his private costs, like the wages he has to pay, the electricity bill, the raw materials that go into making the TVs, and he factors in the fact that he has to pay taxes to the government, maybe it's $2 per television set, so the more TVs he makes, the more higher tax bill, then now he's producing the socially optimal number of television sets. He's fully taken into account all the total cost he's imposing on the rest of society by doing it. That's the idea. So again, just make sure you realize it's the point of a building tax is not to make the thing go to zero. Another example, more relevant to what we're going to be talking about later in this course, if they put in place a carbon tax, there would still be carbon dioxide emissions. The point of a carbon tax is not to tomorrow make carbon emissions go to zero, but the point is to make everybody internalize the externality so that we then do the optimal thing. That's the Pavlovian framework. Okay. So the Coase theorem. So this is a hugely famous result Coase didn't call it a theorem. It was, I think, George Stigler later when summarizing this called it the Coase theorem. All right. The original article was, The problem of social cost. Sorry, my pencil settings got changed when I logged out. Okay, now I'm back. The problem of social cost. This is the most cited law review article in history. And let me just make sure, I'm going to spend a little bit of time, as you could in a law and economics class, they spend at least a lecture on this, sometimes two or three, because this is such an important result. So let me make sure you get this. Also, let me give you the big picture. Ronald Coase's work was supposed to be a counterweight to the standard Pigouvian framework. So make sure you understand that, because a lot of Austrians really don't like this stuff. And I'm going to talk about that in a minute. But so you understand the factions and everything. A lot of free market economists embrace Coase's work here because it shows that the standard Pigouvian framework is naive, or at least is incomplete. And Coase showed it, came up with examples and showed why if you use the standard Pigouvian framework, you would actually end up promoting an inefficient outcome. Okay, so make sure you get that. A lot of free market economists like Coase, and if you're an Austrian and start complaining about them, then they might be puzzled. So I just want to make sure you understand the different factions here. Okay. So, again, what Coase does, he starts this article, and he refreshes everyone's memory as to the standard Pigouvian framework, what I just went over with you guys. And then he says, you know what, this is not a full analysis of the problem, or this is very short-sighted. And the first thing he stresses is that when it comes to these things of social cost, where one person's activities are imposing harms on other parties, and then the issue is, what should the government do about that? He says it's not right, or it's not useful to just look at it as one person is the bad guy or the aggressor, and the other person is the victim. And he said that's typically the way we look at it. So in the last example I went over with the factory making television set and dumping stuff in the river, the way everybody had analyzed that following Pigou is to say the factory owners are the bad guys. They're clearly doing something they shouldn't. They're dumping stuff in the river, and they're violating the property rights of the fishermen down the stream who can now catch less fish because of that. And so clearly the government has to do something to punish the bad guys, the trespassers. And Coase was saying, no, that's not the right way to look at it. So that's what he means by the reciprocal nature of the problem. So he's saying, I'm adapting it to the example I gave you guys. In that setting, Coase's insight is to say, stop looking at it as, oh no, the problem is in order to make television sets, you have to reduce the number of fish. And so that the TV people are bad. Don't look at it like that. Just look at it and say, there's a fundamental conflict here, a technological conflict, where in order to produce more television sets, you have to produce fewer fish. But he's saying, let's not look at it as the TV guys are hurting the fish people. He said, by the same token, it's reciprocal. If the government comes in and says to the TV people, you got to stop because you're hurting the fish people, well, then why couldn't we just interpret it the other way around and say, uh-oh, the problem here is that in order to catch more fish, you have to restrict the number of television sets that society can enjoy. So you see how the move he made there? Let me just say it again because it's kind of important. Coase's fundamental insight was to say, up till now, the way economists have traditionally been analyzing these problems of externalities or social costs diverging from private costs is to look at one party as the aggressor or the bad guy and the other one as the victim. And he's saying we got to stop judging it like that, coming in a priori, thinking we know which party ought to be doing it or not. And he said it's just that there's a conflict. It's a reciprocal problem. You can't have more TVs and more fish at the same time. Just technologically or physically, they interfere with each other. And so the issue is just, what is society, what do we want? Do we want more television sets? Do we want more fish? And then once we answer that question, then the government can go ahead and set policy accordingly so that the right outcome occurs. So something that you're going to have to figure out or get comfortable with to understand both Pigou and Coase is this idea of efficiency in this context. And so this is not, you know, an Austrian conception, and I think Rothbard even has a famous essay on this very topic. But the here what they mean is that, loosely speaking, you want it to be that the you want to do something such that the gains to the winners outweigh the losses to the losers. So that in principle, the people who benefit from a policy change could pay enough to compensate the losers and everybody's better off. It doesn't mean they actually have to pay them. It just means they ought to be able to. So in case that's too abstract, give you an example. In most settings, getting rid of tariffs would promote efficiency in the way I just described it. And if you think about even, you know, regular Henry Hazlitt type or even Rory Rothbard type explanations of free trade, the way they typically run is they'll say something like, yeah, getting rid of a tariff hurts the workers in the protected industry. Their wages go down, but the consumers gain. So like if we're talking about the United States and there had originally been a tariff on automobiles coming from Japan, we could say as free market economists, hey, it's more efficient to get rid of those tariffs. And then if somebody says, well, what do you mean by efficient? A standard response would be to say, well, what we mean is that, yeah, getting rid of the tariffs makes the wages of the U.S. automakers go down, but consumers benefit even more so that the gains, you know, so Americans on net become richer from that move. So if you want to justify getting rid of tariffs by like a natural law argument, that's fine. But if you're going to say it promotes efficiency or it's efficient to move to free trade, and a lot of economists want to talk like that, you don't mean every single person becomes wealthier, because that's not true. Some people really are hurt when you get rid of a tariff. But what you could mean and what is defensible is to say, on average, the country that goes toward free trade gets richer, which means the benefits to the people who gain from it outweigh the losses to the people who lose from it, so that the total benefits are higher than the total losses, and so everybody on average is richer. Okay, so that's kind of what Pigou and Coase mean in this framework. And if you're a little bit confused, don't worry. This next example, I'll try to drive it home. Okay, so this is the what I'm doing here is I'm walking through the first numerical example in Coase's paper in case some of you Google it and want to look it up. So it's I'm not trying to scare you off. It's written in plain English, so it's not like it's a bunch of fancy math equations, but it is he kind of bounces around. Like he'll start working through one example and he won't totally drive home the point, and then he'll slightly tweak the assumption and make a different point. And unless you've studied it a lot and you've had somebody else teach it to you and you've read the secondary literature on it, you're probably going to get mixed up and not, you know, you walk away from Coase's paper not knowing what the heck is going on. So you can try to read it if you want. It's a classic, but I'm just warning you that it is confusing if you're not used to thinking like this. Okay, but anyway, let me at least walk you through the setup of the first example. So in case you do try to read it, you'll have some frame of reference. Okay, so the issue here is there is a rancher who has cattle, and he's living right next to a farmer who's growing crops. And the problem is the larger the herd, the more steers, the more likely it is that they once in a while cross over the property line and go onto the farmer's land and trample his crops, or they eat them or whatever, but they destroy them. So Coates says that in a traditional Pigouvian framework, everybody would just naturally assume that the rancher is at fault, and the issue would be, how do we make sure the rancher internalizes the fact that the bigger the herd he has, the more damages he's imposing on his poor neighbor, the farmer. And so again, Coase's original insight is to say, whoa, don't load the deck against the rancher. The issue is we have a conflict here. There's a reciprocal problem that if we want to have a bigger, if society wants to have a larger herd, you know, we want to devote more resources and expanding the size of that herd, then we have to be willing to tolerate fewer crops and vice versa. If we want to have more crops, and this is the reciprocal nature of the problem, then we have to tolerate a smaller herd. So the issue is not, oh, the rancher is imposing cost on the farmer. He's saying it's a reciprocal thing. We can have one or the other, and the issue is, which one do we want? It's not a matter of morality or something like that. Okay, so he's making some assumptions, and you'll see in a minute why this stuff is relevant. So one thing to keep in mind is he's saying, imagine that it costs $9 to build a fence between the farmer and the ranch's property, and there's a $9 annual cost to keep it, to maintain it, and that would keep the steers out. And then another thing that I'm putting in here just to make it simpler, assume that the rancher for some reason can only have up to a herd of size 4. Another assumption Coase makes is that a ton of crops can be sold for $1. And then he gives this table. So this is pretty straightforward, but the idea is if there's no fence, left to their own devices, the larger the herd, in terms of number of steers, the greater the total crop damage. And then this is the marginal figure. So notice that these are just the difference of the middle column. Okay, so if you go from 1 to 2, the rancher could have 1 steer and then he decides to have 2, the crop damage goes from 1 up to 3 tons per year. And so that means the marginal damage goes from 1 to 2, because 2 is 3 minus 1. And then if he has 4, the total crop damage is 10, and the marginal crop damage is 4, because 10 minus 6 is 4. Okay, so where these numbers are coming from is the marginal numbers keep going up by 1, so that the first steer causes 1 ton of crop damage per year. But if you have 2 steers, on the margin, that second steer is causing 2 tons of crop damage per year. If you have 3 steers, on the margin, that third steer is causing 3 tons of damage. Because you see how the totals here are going up by 2, 3, 4. And the first one's 1, because it goes from 0 to 1. Okay, so that's where those numbers are coming from. All right, so now, assuming that there's no transaction cost, and I'm plugging in here just to make the math more simple, or other production costs. Let's walk through what would happen. First, we're going to assume that a steer has a market price of $2.50. So there's 2 scenarios we want to walk through here, with the price being $2.50. First, assume that the rancher is liable. So I'm just writing are liable. Okay, so what I mean is we're going to assume that the government comes in legally says to the rancher, hey, if your animals cause crop damage to the farmer, he can come and tell you to stop. You know, you don't have the legal right to let your animals just run roughshod over your neighbor's property. So now what's the outcome going to be? So if it's $2.50, so you might originally think, oh, well, there's not going to be any, the size of the herd is going to be zero, right? Because the farmer's just going to say to the rancher, I don't want you messing with my stuff, stop it. And the government's going to say the farmer has the legal right to do that. And so the rancher is going to say, okay, but that's not what's going to happen. What's going to happen is they're going to come to a deal. And so if the steers sell for $250 and there's no transaction costs and there's perfect information and all that other stuff, the deal they will come to is that the rancher will maintain a herd of size 2. Because for every additional steer that he has, he can sell it for $2.50. And so he would be willing to say to the farmer, yeah, you have the legal right to stop me. You can say, you know, I don't want any of your animals coming onto my property. I'm gonna call the government and they're gonna shut you down. But I, the rancher, don't want you to do that. I will pay you $2.25 for each of the two steers if you let them come onto your land and occasionally trample your crops. And so that would be a win-win for both of them, because the rancher makes $2.50, and again, we've assumed no other cost, so that's pure profit per steer, per head. And so long as the number of steers is 1 or 2, then the marginal damage to the farmer is not higher than $2.25. So they would both be happy with that. But he couldn't give him a bribe or a compensation payment to let him pick or let him maintain a herd of size 3. Because a herd of size 3, the marginal damage is 3 tons of crops, and the crops sell for $1 a ton. So if the rancher has a herd of size 3, on the margin, that wouldn't make sense, because he would have to offer at least $3 to the farmer to make the farmer acquiesce in letting that third animal occasionally cross onto his property and trample the crops. But it wouldn't be worth the rancher to pay that much for it, because he doesn't make $3 from it. Okay, so again, If the rancher is liable, meaning if the farmer has the legal property right to say, you are not allowed to come onto my property with your animals and shut him down if he does, then Coase is saying, as long as they can freely negotiate, the outcome is going to be a herd of size 2, and the rancher is going to make payments to the farmer to compensate him for the trampled crops. Okay. Now, suppose, I'm just going to cross it out, suppose the rancher is not liable, right? Suppose the farmer does not have the legal right to stop him. But, you know, the farmer calls up the government, says, hey, my next door neighbor, his animals are on my property eating everything and trampling stuff, stop him. And the government says, nah, that's fine, that's harmless. Animals will be animals, that is normal. And if that seems weird to you, well, suppose the farmer called up and said, my next door neighbor has cattle and they smell bad, and I want him to have a herd of size 0 because I don't like that stench. And then you could imagine the police officer, whoever he called, saying, well, no, but he's on his land with animals, and yeah, animals stink, and he would be interfering with his property right to have a herd if his neighbors can say, we don't want to have a stench. Okay, so this is what Coase is getting at, is once you start getting more specific with real-world examples, it's not obvious what the property rights should be. Because if one party gets stronger property rights, that infringes on the ability of the other party to do what they want to do with their property. Okay, so if you can see why maybe the farmer can't shut the guy down just because odors are coming onto his land, then it's not inconceivable that somebody could, that a judge could say, you know, oh, come on. You're going to have cattle. They occasionally roam around, and the fact that you lose some crops every year, that's just kind of, that's life. You know, he could say that. Just like if your neighbors were having a wild party, you could imagine the judge saying, well, I'm sorry, but I can't tell them to not have a party. So by the same token, the judge might say, I can't tell him to have a herd of size zero. So that's the idea. Okay, so what happens in this case? And here's the crucial insight with what Coase is saying is, so long as there's no transaction cost and the parties can bargain freely, the same outcome is going to occur with these numbers. That the rancher originally would want to have four, right? If he can do whatever he wants, there's no legal mechanism stopping him, he would want to have four. But the farmer, realizing, oh my gosh, my neighbor wants to have four steers, and that's going to cause me 10 tons of crop damage, the farmer would be willing to pay him up to $3 to eliminate this one and up to $4 to eliminate this one. And the rancher only makes $2.50 for each additional steer. So there's plenty of scope there for the farmer to make an offer to say, hey, I'll pay you to reduce your the size of your herd. And he would agree to it. Okay, so again, the same outcome would occur. And when I say the word outcome there, that's what we mean when we're talking about efficiency in a Pigouvian or a Coasean framework. We mean, like, what's the size of the herd? How many crops are produced? Because you might say, well, no, it's not the same outcome. Depending on who gets the legal rule, one party's richer than the other one. Because in the first case, the rancher's making payments to the farmer, and in the second case, the farmer's making payments to the rancher, and that's true. But that's not what Coase and Pigou mean by, you know, an allocation of resources. They're thinking about production and what does society do with its scarce resources in terms of making production decisions. Okay, so because we're running low on time here, let me just go a little bit more quickly on this example. What I may do is we might come back next week and cover some of this stuff if I just totally run out of time, because I don't want to rush this too quickly. But again, big picture with the Coase theorem here is you might have originally thought that the size of the herd that the rancher would optimize on would be dependent upon whether he had a legal right to let his animals graze on his neighbor's crops and trample them, or whether the farmer could just shut him down if he wanted to and call him the force of the law. And what Coase is saying is no, so long as they can freely negotiate with each other, that's not the case. That whatever the efficient outcome would have been in one scenario is what's going to happen in the other scenario too. And the only difference between those two outcomes is going to be a side payment. Just to round out this example, if the steers sold for $4.50 each, then the efficient outcome would be for the rancher to have a herd of size four and somebody builds a fence. That's the cheapest way to deal with the problem. And so if the liability rule falls on the rancher so that the farmer can say, stop, if the steer have a price of $4.50 each, and again, assume there's no other cost of production, then the rancher is going to say, okay, and just pay the $9 every year to keep the fence up so he can have his four, herd of size four. Because it's better, it's cheaper to build a fence of $9 per year than it would be to have a herd of size four trampling 10 tons of crops every year and having to pay $10. That's where that number's coming from. That 9 is lower than 10. But then if the rancher cannot be stopped by the law, if the farmer can't stop the rancher by calling up the government, because the legal system does not recognize that the rancher has a property right in excluding cattle from coming onto his property periodically, then, and if the steer sell for $4.50, the farmer knows, okay, I'm going to have to pay my neighbor at least $4.50 for every, you know, and he wants to have four, so I'm going to pay him $4.50 times four to get him to be willing to have a herd, to withdraw or restrict his herd size. But wait a minute, instead of me paying that much, I'll just pay $9 and build a fence, and that will solve the problem. Okay, so what Coase is getting at here is that in certain situations, the easiest way to solve this reciprocal problem is some technological device like building a fence, or if it's an issue of like sound pollution and, you know, there's neighbors who are having a party all the time, one solution is to like soundproof their house or to build some kind of barrier in between their house and the other people's houses to muffle the sound. Okay, and so I'm not going to give you a specific example because it would take too much time, but part of what Coase did in this paper was to show, using the standard Pigouvian framework, you might miss something like that. That if the government just came in and assumed it knew what the outcome should be and levied a tax, that would cause a restriction in a particular industry because of the tax, when really, no, a cheaper solution was available that they could have just, you know, paid some upfront money and done something that would have solved the problem permanently without having to do this annual payment of taxes. That's the idea. Okay, let me clarify what the Coase theorem was, because a lot of people misunderstand it. It is not to say transaction costs in the real world are low enough that property rights don't matter. All right, so I'm putting an X through that. A lot of people, when they hear the Coase theorem described, walk away thinking, oh, what Ronald Coase said was that in the real world, so long as transaction costs are low enough, it doesn't matter what the property rights assignments are, people can just make side deals, and so really, it doesn't really matter. You know, just as long as the government defines property rights somehow, that's the important thing, and then let people make bargains, and that's it. So that is not what Ronald Coase was saying. Rather, what he was saying is, he's saying, look, if transaction costs were low enough, then it wouldn't matter what the government did. So the issue of should the farmer have the right to stop cattle from coming onto his property, or should the rancher have the right to have a herd and occasionally they, you know, wander away and he kind of shoos them back? Who should have the relevant right? Coase was saying if transaction costs were low enough, it wouldn't matter. The same outcome would occur. But he says in the real world, sometimes there are significant transaction costs. And so what the government needs to do is assign the property right that yields the efficient outcome. So let me say that in different words. In the real world, Coase acknowledged that sometimes transaction costs are high, and it's not feasible for every party who is affected by an event to make a deal with all the relevant people making the decisions. And so in that case, what the government or the judge should do is think through what would be the outcome if there were no transaction cost, because we know that would be the efficient outcome. And now in the real world, assign the property right so that that efficient outcome is what happens. So to give you an example, like when it comes to air pollution. So if there's a factory making cars and is shooting stuff into the air, and there's 50,000 people in the city who are now breathing in dirty air. And so it's unpleasant, it makes some people cough, and it might, you know, cause lung cancer or increase the chance of lung cancer. Ronald Coase would say, if there's no transaction costs, the same thing is going to happen. Whether the government says the factory owner has the legal right to pump stuff into the air, or whether the government says the people living around that factory have the legal right to exclude dirty air from entering their lungs, either way, again, with no transaction costs, the same outcome is going to occur. So depending on the, and we don't know what the answer is going to be, depending on the numbers, and again, this is a very coaching in perspective, we can't automatically say the efficient thing is for there to be no pollution. That might not be true. Maybe the efficient thing to do is for that factory to pump out pollution and then pay people, or the people all move. Because again, the reciprocal nature of the problem, the issue is not that there's pollution. The issue is this guy wants to make stuff and just send stuff in the air, and these people all want to live there. If those people didn't want to live there, there'd be no problem. So again, the reciprocal nature of the issue is not how do we stop the factory owner. It's you have to step back and look at the numbers and figure out what's the efficient thing. And Coase is saying if there's no transaction cost, there would be 50,000 deals between the factory owner and each person. And whether he had the right to pump stuff in the atmosphere or whether they had the right to clean air, the same outcome would occur. Either they would be paying him to not pollute, or he would be paying them to agree to it, or he would have the right to do it and they wouldn't pay him because it wouldn't be worth it and he would end up polluting, or I forget the third or the fourth permutation of what I said. But okay, so we don't know without putting specific numbers what the correct outcome is, but the point is the assignment of the legal rule would not affect that so long as all the 50,000 people could bargain with the guy who owned the factory. So again, a lot of people, especially people who don't like free market economists, they think that what Ronald Coase is saying is, hey, we don't need environmental regulation because we can just all cut side deals with polluters and pay them, you know, we each pay them $3 to not pollute. And so then on the margin, he says, well, 1 million people are going to pay me $3 each. That's $3 million. I'll just shut down and collect checks every year instead of polluting. And that's more money than I would make by producing my output. And then the environmentalist says, oh my gosh, that's so stupid. 3 million people can't, or 1 million people can't be drawn up contracts with the factory owner. That's ridiculous. And that's true. That is ridiculous, but that's not what Coase was saying. What he was saying is when the judge or the regulator for the government is trying to decide on issues of can the factory pollute or can the homeowners stop them with an injunction, what they need to do is try to figure out, picture what would happen in this scenario if they could, if all these millions of people could make side deals with the owner, what would happen? And so now, since they can't do that, let's draw the legal rules such that that same outcome occurs. So if we think the real outcome would be all the people living there would pay the owner a little bit of money each so that on the margin he would just discontinue production altogether, well, then the correct legal rule would be to say to the factory owner, you don't have the right to do that because that will give us the same outcome. But if we think, you know, if it's something like flying a plane overhead and it kind of bothers some people when they're in their backyard and see a plane going by and they want to sue the airport and say, no, you can't send planes over my property. What are you doing? That bothers me. It makes me nervous that the plane's going to drop something on my face, or it blocks my view of the sun for 2 seconds when the plane goes overhead. So stop. And if the Coasean judge runs the numbers and says, if there were no transaction costs and the airport had the legal right to let planes fly over neighborhoods that, you know, at a sufficiently high altitude, I don't think very many people in practice would be willing to pay very much money to not have planes going overhead. and certainly they wouldn't be willing to pay enough to make it unprofitable to have airlines. And so we think that at zero transaction cost, the outcome would still have planes flying over residential areas. It's sufficiently high altitude. And so now in the real world, since we can't have everybody in the continental U.S. have side agreements with all the owners of airports and planes, we'll just set the legal rule that if you own a plane and you fly high enough, you're allowed to do that. A property owner can't stop you from doing that. Okay, so that's the way the Coase theorem works. Okay, because we're kind of low on time, so go ahead and start putting your questions in the Q&A. And I'll go a little bit over time, but then I'll come back depending on how many questions we're filling in and then we'll cover some of this stuff next week. Okay, so Walter Block's critique of this stuff. And he's written a lot of it. In particular, he's had debates with Demsetz, who is a huge figure in this Chicago School law and economics approach. So Coase's article spawned an entire field of like a Chicago School law and economics approach based on this stuff. And so Walter Block hates this with a passion. And he critiqued it. And so let me just give you, and I'm drawing on stuff that not just Walter brought in, but if you want to, you know, he summarized a lot of these things. So there's a lot of problems with that Coasean approach. But again, that might surprise you because a lot of free market economists embrace Coase thinking, oh, well, this is great. This is showing the limitations of the standard Pigouvian argument for levying taxes. And it showed how, you know, the dynamic, the versatility of a market, people making side deals and that kind of stuff. And so in one respect, free market people usually like Coase, but Rothbard and Block and many other Austrians don't think that that's a good approach. Okay, so some of the issues are, first of all, willingness versus ability to pay. So one of the things going on in these examples is if somebody has the right to do something, the legal right to do something, the other party has to pay them to not do it. And so one of the Coasean insights is to say, well, whether you have whether the legal right is with one party or the other, it doesn't matter. The same thing's going to happen because you'll just make a side payment. But that kind of makes sense if you're thinking about little marginal changes. When it comes to, you know, crop damage and stuff like that, and oh, should there be one more animal in the herd or one fewer, and the farmer can just pay a few dollars more per year. It sounds kind of plausible, but if you change the example, it can sound crazy and you can really see the problem. So, what if we're debating some rules and one of them is, you know, should Bob Murphy have the legal right to not be picked up and brought over to Egypt and to serve as somebody's slave? And so right now the default legal position is, yeah, if somebody tries to do that to me, I can object and say, oh, no, to have me go do that, you'd have to pay me a lot of money. But if they flipped it and all of a sudden the default was, no, anybody who wants to can grab me and bring me over and I have to serve as somebody's slave in Egypt, and then I could then you could say, well, no, it's the same outcome because, if you know, the efficient outcome, if Murphy's willing to pay $100,000 to avoid that outcome and he's only worth $90,000 as a slave to somebody, well, then that's what's going to happen either way. You know, so if he gets to retain ownership of his body, then they would only be willing to pay $90,000 to make him a slave. And he would say, no, you have to pay me at least $100,000, so it's not going to happen. Or if the default's the other way, then they're about to grab me. And I said, whoa, I'll pay you $100,000 if you don't do this to me. And they would say, oh, you're only worth $90,000 worth as a slave. Well, yeah, we'll take your $100,000 and we both part ways. So either way, I stay here in the U.S. and my body doesn't get, or my labor doesn't get diverted to whatever I would be doing over in Egypt. Okay? But the problem is, now I'm out $100,000 if I had to just pay those people off. And so if you kept doing that for various things that right now the default is that I own, well, after a while I'm going to run out of money. Okay? And so what if I don't have very much money left because you made me pay people to not come sleep in my house? And I've had to pay people, you know, for all kinds of other things. And now I don't have very much wealth left. And so now they ask me, hey, how much are you willing to pay so we don't grab you and take you over to Egypt to be a slave? And I say, $6,000, because that's all I have left, because I've already had to pay it out to everybody else in side payment. Well, then they grab me and take me. And the point is, from a Coasean framework, that's the efficient thing now, because they would say, well, Bob's labor in Egypt is worth $100,000 to these people, and Bob's labor in the United States is worth only $6,000 to him, as gauged by his willingness to pay. But that's all he's willing to do. We asked him, hey, do you want to, how much are you willing to bid so that we don't grab you? And he only said $6,000. So the efficient thing, you know, it maximizes social wealth to have him go to Egypt and be this guy's slave. Right? Because they benefited by $100,000 and I only lost by $6,000. Okay? So you understand, I mean, I'm picking an inflammatory example, but that's, I'm just trying to do justice to Walter Block's rhetorical style. You get the issue. And I'm saying we didn't caricature, that is the Chicago School Ronald Coasean law and economics approach. Or Block has another example of, you know, strictly speaking, if you took them literally at face value, who is the rightful owner of the money in your wallet, and should it be illegal for a mugger to come up and grab your wallet? Strictly speaking, the way the coast theorist would have to answer that is to say, well, let me think through who gets more utility from that money, you or the mugger. And, you know, if the mugger were willing to pay enough to get your wallet more than you were, well, then the law should assign the property rights to him. Because we know with zero transaction costs, he would be willing to get, you know, he would be willing to get more, or he would be willing to pay more to get your wallet than you would be willing to pay to keep it. Okay, so there's that example. If you think through that, that blows your mind on several fronts. First of all, it just really drives home this idea of we're moving away from having a sense of justice and who really is the owner, and we're just going into this weird utilitarian thing of, we'll say the owner is the person such that some conception of social utility is maximized. And then the other thing, too, in that particular example is, it's kind of weird to say, how much would you pay to be able to retain your cash? You know, if we're talking about a $100 bill and saying, who's the owner of this, you know, wouldn't we both be willing to pay $100? I mean, that's kind of weird. All right. So that's another thing where, when it comes to things that have a pretty precise monetary value, the Coasean framework, it looks a little odd. Okay. Another obvious problem with all this stuff is the subjective value. And that includes costs, of course, because costs are values of foregone opportunities, and so those are ultimately subjective as well. So maybe some of you felt vaguely uneasy this whole lecture that was just casually thrown around terms like marginal benefits exceeding the social cost and that kind of stuff. But that very framework doesn't make sense to a Rothbardian, because, you know, what does it mean to talk about some objective social cost of something beyond the private psychic utility experience by individuals, and you can't aggregate that stuff. And that even if you could, there's a Hayekian knowledge problem. So even if it did make sense to say, choose the legal rule such that the benefits to the winners exceed the losses to the losers, in practice, how would you know that? And then, of course, there's a public choice issue of you start giving judges the ability to start changing property rights based on their seat-of-the-pants calculation about social benefits and costs, you just opened up Pandora's box. And, you know, that kind of defeats the purpose of property rights in the first place. You can't make long-term contracts if you're worried that a judge in 10 years is going to rerun the numbers and say, oh, actually, upon further review, we think this legal rule now would promote social welfare. Okay, so there's all kinds of problems with this framework. Okay, let me turn to your question. So like I say, we have the Rothbardian paper and free market environmentalism. I'm going to come back and touch on that stuff next week. So if you haven't already read it, I would encourage you to go ahead and read the Rothbard selection for next week. Okay, Nathan Hayes asks, are Coase and Pigou approaching these problems from a fundamental utilitarian perspective? Yes, in the way that I described. That they're more concerned about, they have a framework of social benefits and costs, and they want to maximize social welfare. Okay, Wesley Bruce says, has anyone looked at both parties paying half? How does that change the numbers? Well, it wouldn't. I think I know what you mean, Wesley, and it's as long as there's a strict definition of who has what property right, the outcome's not going to change in terms of the size of the herd or whatever the issue is, the example is. It would reduce the net payment from one side to the other. David Scott says, as Coase's ideas move authority from the law and the individual to the administration government, has it changed the power structure in contemporary Western society? I don't know enough. I mean, I don't know the history of the actual law, and I don't. Coase's approach has been used in at least limited settings. So when it comes to areas where the government had to assign new property rights because it was an area where traditionally property rights didn't exist, so things like, you know, auctioning off spectrum for radio communications or things with like the internet. And I don't know enough about the technical details to be able to speak knowledgeably, but since 1960, because of technological changes, the government has had to wade into, either because of direct statutory legislation or because judges had to make rulings on legal cases that involved issues that wouldn't have come up before 1960. Yes, they've had to, in a sense, codify property rights in new areas, and at least some of them have been influenced by the Chicago School framework. So whether you think that's a good thing or a bad thing depends whether you think it's a good framework or not, I suppose. Jody Underwood says, please clarify Block's last example using the 2x2 table. The example seemed forced. It seemed like he was redefining socialist, communist, and capitalist. Capitalists are never coerced. Socialists are always coerced. Do you agree with his example? Are you talking about, Jody, like from the YouTube video? If you are, I didn't. I mean, let me think. I think I know what you're talking about, and I would need to watch that part again to be utterly sure. I think what he's saying is he's trying to be precise with language, and he wants to say you could be a socialist voluntarily. and again, I would have to go watch the last few minutes because I've heard him made this argument in other contexts. So I know the general framework he's using, but I don't remember exactly what he said at the 2x2 table. But what Block is trying to get at is he wants to be more specific and say, hey, you could have a group of libertarian socialists, right? So they're not aggressing. We could all just agree. We could all go move somewhere, and we could buy the land from the surrounding capitalists. And, you know, everybody, the Rothbardian judges would all agree that, yep, they have a legal title to this land, and we're like 100 of us. And then we all read Karl Marx and blah, 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 and we all say, you know what, let's all be socialist. And we all agreed. It wasn't because we were deep down worried that someone was going to punch us or shoot us or something. We all voluntarily put all of our money into a common pool, and maybe we even came up with some method of deciding who the government was every year. But if we truly all literally agreed to that up front, then that's not coercive. Just like, you know, Block thinks you could sell yourself into slavery, and that's not coercive, even though for some people, slavery by definition is coercive. Okay, so that's all he's trying to say. What he's trying to get at is that the idea of communal ownership per se is not anti-libertarian. What's anti-libertarian is coercion. And that's not necessarily that has to be identified with individuals owning private property. Yeah, so there could be like a monastery. That's a good example, a more plausible example. You could have a bunch of people for religious reasons going into a monastery, and Block is saying, you know, there's a plausible meaning of the word socialism that would apply there. Okay, Jody, if he said something more, okay, you know what, Jody, I'll go review it. It's possible that I would agree with you. So I don't want to be giving him a blanket endorsement when maybe you're right. Maybe if I look at a specific example, I would agree. Oh, yeah, you kind of fumbled that one. So let me go look at it again. All right, let me just answer one more from Tyler here. Tyler says, I get the superficial Pavlovian argument against negative externalities, but the positives rely on assuming a certain valuation of the externality by all taxpayers. Is there more to this argument? It seems much weaker than the negative externality argument. Okay, that's a great question. And then after I answer this, we'll end it. Let me just rephrase that, because I think I know what you mean, but let me just say it back. In other words, I think what you're saying is, look at Pigou is assuming that it's wrong. You know, if we produce an extra television set that dumps stuff in the river and that kills you're fine with the negative externality, that we're going to tax him and restrict him. But wait a minute. If we subsidize somebody who's conferring benefits on society, but actually it's really only conferring benefits on this group of people over here, well, the government subsidies are coming from tax revenue, ultimately. And so that seems weird that you're taxing some people who might not even care about that. So if you're subsidizing, I don't know what, a fireworks display, because you're like, oh, you know what, we can't charge each individual, and the more fireworks we make, the more people who benefit from it, and so why don't we just use tax dollars to subsidize it because it's a public good, blah, blah, blah. But what if there's somebody out there who hates fireworks? He thinks they're loud and obnoxious, so under what social rule could we possibly justify taking more of his tax dollars to pay people to do something that he can't stand? Okay, I think strictly speaking, it's because they're not making an individual argument. They're not saying that under the Pigouvian framework, every single individual is improved. What they're saying is society in general is made better off, so that in principle, the winners could compensate the losers. So what would have to be the case in the firework example is the people who are benefiting from seeing the fireworks would be willing to pay enough so that the people who don't like more fireworks, you know, receiving that payment would say, oh, yeah, I'm willing to tolerate a few more explosions if I get $50 because I can just go to my house and close the blinds and put my head under a pillow. And I'll do that for $50. So the idea is, in principle, you could pay enough from the winners to compensate the losers. And if the numbers didn't work out like that, well, then on that it would be a negative externality. Okay, so to be a positive externality means that on net, doing more of this activity causes more social benefits than social harms. And so I think that's the way they would answer that. Okay, thanks everybody. Like I said, next week we will cover Rothbard's article on this and I'll also give you some examples of free market environmentalism.